Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Studio team.
And I'm Chet Haas from the Android Developer Relations team. And today we have...
Mess Aya. I'm on the Android Studio team where I work on compilers.
Welcome.
Thank you.
The proper pronunciation. We've just been calling you Mats, but that's not how you pronounced it. It's good to know.
Yeah, the D is silent. It's kind of weird. I'm Danish.
Right.
Or Anish. As they say there.
Yeah, the D is silent.
In that case, the D is not silent, but thanks, Chet.
All right, so we can talk about everything that your team does today, and that's quite a bit. Do you want to sort of give us a quick overview of where you sit in the Android Studio team and what you work on?
Sure. So I'm on the Android Studio compilers team. So we work on everything compilers in Android Studio. So in general, I have sort of three areas that I cover. So one is D8 and R8. So D8 is a dexer. It turns Java class files into Dalvik executable files that can actually run on an Android device. And then there's R8, which is an application shrinker, which tries to make your Android app small. So that's sort of one group of people.
Small and fast, right?
Small and fast.
What is your trade-off? Like, do you care more about speed or do you care more about size?
We care more about size. And the reason why we care more about size is that speed is really hard to reason about because we have roughly like 5 to 7 years of VMs of Android runtimes that we care about at any given point in time. And all of them have different performance trade-offs. So optimizing for speed in this ecosystem is actually kind of challenging in the sense that when you make something fast for one of them, it typically regresses on something else. But the one thing that is always a plus is making your app smaller. And that typically also helps in terms of performance, actually.
So like loop and rolling, that's a often done for speed, but it makes your code larger. I guess that is a optimization you would not make.
That's a good example of something that we will not do. Yes, that is up okay. to the runtime. And then the runtime will compile our code again, right, and generate native code for it. If they want to do loop and rolling for speed, we're really happy with that, but we don't do it at the Dex code level.
All right. So I interrupted you in the middle of D8 and R8. Anything else your team works on?
Sure. So that was that group. Then there's Kotlin compilers, where we work with JetBrains on accelerating two projects that they have. So those two projects combined will basically replace the current Kotlin JVM compiler with a brand new one. So there are two projects. It's a backend and a frontend. And we're interested in both of them for various reasons. So maybe we should talk about that a little later.
Is one of those reasons performance?
Yes. But compile time performance, not necessarily runtime performance. But yes, right. Compile time is definitely one of those reasons.
Can I ask, front end and back end? Maybe I should be more of a compiler person than I am, but can you explain what you meant?
Absolutely. So when you write Kotlin code, the Kotlin compiler has two parts, a front end and a back end. The front end is responsible for basically making sure that your program is a valid Kotlin program. So it will look at the characters that you typed in. It will build an abstract syntax tree. It will do type checking. In the case of Kotlin, it will also do type inference because there are places in the Kotlin language where you do not have to write explicit types. So it's part of the front end to also infer types where you didn't write them explicitly and then make sure that your program is actually type correct so that it's a valid Kotlin program. Once the front end has done that, then it's on to the back end. And it's the job of the back end to then generate the code that will actually run. So in the case of Kotlin, for many use cases, that is class files, either to be run on a Java virtual machine, on a server, for instance, or it gets compiled with the D8 compiler to Dex code, which can run on an Android device.
So when you describe the process for like validating that this is proper Kotlin code, is that similar to what would happen in a compiler for the Java programming language? Or is this an additional step that is specific to Kotlin?
It's the same kind of thing, but it is specific to Kotlin, right? It's a Kotlin
compiler.
The
concept of front ends and back ends is a very general compiler concept.
I see.
Absolutely.
And,
yes.
And it's useful because like in the tools, they will reuse the compiler front end to do all the syntax validation, seeing the IDE, but obviously you don't want to generate code on the fly as you're typing. And this is why some people are interested in a faster front end.
And that would be us, Tor.
Okay. All right. How is that coming along?
It's going well. So the back end is going really well. In fact, it's experimental, or supposed to be officially experimental, in Kotlin 1.4. So it's feature complete. We have a lot of things running on it. In particular, Jetpack Compose is always using the IR backend. If people don't know what Jetpack Compose is, it's the new up-and-coming Android UI toolkit based on Kotlin. And it uses the new backend because it operates as a compiler plugin. And the new backend has a much better infrastructure for writing compiler plugins. It has an intermediate representation, so an internal representation of the code that is much easier to work with than the previous backend. And that's very useful for Jetpack Compose, because one of the things that Jetpack Compose does is that it has a compiler plugin that rewrites your code behind the scenes. It's very similar to what the Kotlin compiler does for suspend functions. So it threads around extra state, called a composer, and does calls on that. But you don't have to write it yourself. The compiler, the Jetpack Compose compiler plugin, does that for you. So one of the reasons why we're engaging in this new backend is that that's needed for Jetpack Compose. So we have a very big interest in making that a success. So the backend is very far. It's ready to be used. It's going to be officially experimental in 1.4. So anyone listening, please try it out when 1.4 comes out, and give us feedback and tell us and or JetBrains what is broken, what doesn't work, so we can fix it. This is an important piece of the Jetpack Compose puzzle for us.
So yeah, when you're using Android Studio with Compose today, you're already opting into a special version of the Kotlin compiler, right? Which has been enabled with this backend.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to ask similarly. You said try it out when 1.4 is out, but in fact, it's already sort of out specifically if you're doing Compose stuff, right?
Absolutely. So if you want to try it out on your projects, there's a compiler flag, and I'm sure that we will provide more information on that once 1.4 is actually out.
Do you know anything about the 1.4 timeline? Where are we now with 1.4?
I think we're getting close. I think we're getting really close to a release. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with the exact dates.
That's fine. But so we're now in the last milestones, I guess.
We're definitely at the home stretch. Yes, it should be out soon.
So that was the back end. So then I assume the other follow up question is, how is the front end going? Is that in parallel? Like you've got separate people working on both sides?
Yes, that's in parallel. It's going well, but it's younger and it's not as complete. But it's very exciting. So the reason why we're engaging in the new front end is for speed, not runtime speed, but compile speed. And the numbers are very exciting. So we're seeing a 4 to 5 times speed up compared to the current front end. And that's really exciting, in particular since 60 to 80% of your Kotlin compilation time is spent in the front end. So having like a factor of 4 or 5 improvement on that is going to be really, really good for Kotlin compile time, and also for Kotlin in the editor, we hope.
Yeah, and in the editor, it's really all the time is spent in the front end. There is no back end. So whenever you're editing a large Kotlin file and it's taking a while, you're waiting for the front end.
Correct.
Is that like lint checks and quick fixes? Like, is that all going through front ends, like sort of checking what's going on in the syntax tree?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it runs the Kotlin front end to do all the, you know, to build up the parse trees, basically, and then to do the symbol resolution. After that, there's lint running, there's ID inspections. We don't consider those part of the compiler front end. Those also contribute to some of the delay, but recently the Kotlin plugin has been sort of changed a bit so that it'll really separate those passes. So when the front end is complete, you will see the error markers right away. It will not wait for all the other highlighting layers like lint to complete before it shows the error markers. So you get them faster than before, but still you're waiting a long time in some cases.
So that was a huge improvement. What did you say, 4 to 5 times? What was there, like a single thing? Like, what did you remove a sleep call? Like, what's the main effort in speeding this up so substantially?
Yeah, so the main effort here, and I should say that I don't want to take credit for this. This was driven by JetBrains engineers, and we just recently joined the effort. But the main thing is that it's a complete rewrite of the front end. So the old front end used to basically have two structures. One is called PSI, which is basically sort of a very source code, like a representation that's very close to the actual source code that's in your editor. And then the front end would look at that, and then it would determine whether your program made sense. It would infer types. And then all of that information about your program, it would store in a separate structure on the side called the binding context. That's not how the new front end operates. The new front end operates in a more sort of traditional compiler structure way, where it has an abstract syntax tree that's annotated with types directly. So it doesn't have this dual structure thing. And it seems like the structure on the side was very slow. And then having the chance to rewrite all of this, I think our good colleagues at JetBrains just did a really good job at designing this for speed from the beginning and really caring about it all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of attention paid to the old implementation looking for optimization possibilities. I think they squeezed all the, you know, all the possible performance they could get out of it. There were no obvious, you know, hotspots that you could sort of cache in an easy way. So this was basically required.
Is this also a 1.4 thing in the experimental when it comes out?
That is not part of that. No. So the state right now is that it's capable of allowing through valid Kotlin code for a lot of code. Sometimes it will put in error types. So basically it won't be able to make sense of valid Kotlin code. So it's still at that stage, right? It still cannot make sense of all Kotlin code, but most Kotlin code. Also, there are cases where it doesn't reject programs that are actually invalid Kotlin code where it should. And finally, the translation to the backend. So the way the compiler works with a new frontend is that that's actually where we're going to replace the entire thing, right? So the new backend is going to work with the old frontend. So old frontend, new backend. That's going to be experimental in 1.4. Later, when the front end is ready, it'll be new front end and new back end. So where Google is helping here is also in that middle layer where we go from the front end's intermediate representation to the new back end's intermediate representation so that we have a full compiler pipeline. So we're working on that and making good progress, but it's not ready for prime time yet.
Yeah, and then the PSI data structures you mentioned are required in the tools for things like refactoring. And so you still have to have a bridge to that in some cases. So that's additional work for either JetBrains or us or both.
Yep.
Can I ask this is probably going to be a dumb question. I've heard that one of the holdouts in performance of the Kotlin compiler overall is the annotation processor, just in the amount of stuff that it pulls in. And there's been some work on that going along. Some of the compiler improvements in the last year, I think, were based on improvements specifically in that area. Can you help me understand why? Like, why is that so expensive on top of everything else going on?
Yes, I can. And actually, I was saying that I had overall three groups working on things, and that's actually the third group. So there are a couple of engineers working on Kotlin symbol processing, or KSP, which is supposed to be a sort of Kotlin first annotation processing system. So the reason why annotation processing for Kotlin has been slow up to now is that the way it operates is actually that Kotlin does not have a native annotation processing system. So what happens instead is that the Kotlin compiler will generate Java class files, or sort of stub Java class files. It will not have method bodies, but it'll have all of your declarations and all of your annotations. And then it will actually run a Java annotation processor on those class files. And then the output of that will then be fed back into KAPT and the Kotlin compiler for another round. And then if there are new annotations that require new annotation processing, then that loop will continue for a bit. So, by the way,
until 6 months ago or so, that was also not incremental. So we had someone working on making KAPT incremental. So at least you have that going for you. But still, there's a lot of inefficiency.
Exactly. Right. So what we did recently, Chet, and that was the Gradle team under Android Studio, they made KPT annotation processors, made it possible for those to be incremental, or annotation processors in general, for them to be incremental. What we're trying to do with KSP is get away from relying on Java annotation processors. And that has multiple upsides. One of the things that we're sort of looking at, which could potentially be a big deal, is Kotlin multi-platform, right? And for Kotlin multi-platform, if you want to target native code, it doesn't really make sense to have annotation processing that generates Java stubs and then runs a Java compiler plugin, which is their annotation processor, to generate Kotlin code that you then feed in and generate native code from. It seems kind of weird, right? I mean, there's something wrong there. So in that sense, we like to get Java C out of the picture here. And then the other part of it is that's basically that part as well. It is also really slow, right? So we want to make it fast. And having to generate class files in order to spin up another tool to generate stuff and then go back to the compiler seems like a waste. So KSP is a Kotlin compiler plugin, which gives you an API to inspect your Kotlin code and generate new Kotlin code based on what you see. And that Kotlin code is then fed into the same compilation that you're already doing and becomes part of the compilation. And then you finalize the compilation and output your code.
So does that mean that you are not generating Kotlin source? You're generating Kotlin intermediate representation?
No, we are generating Kotlin source.
Okay. So that's going to make things a little slower than necessary, but I guess it's a lot simpler for annotation authors?
I think that is a lot simpler, yes. We could allow you to generate code. The problem with that is, again, multi-platform. If you generate code, then either you need to generate native code, JavaScript code, or Java class files.
I was hoping you could generate IR.
Right. We were thinking about that. If you want to generate IR, I think what you should do instead is actually write a full-fledged compiler plugin yourself. And you can do that. And that's the way Jetpack Compose operates. When it does rewritings of your code, it operates as a full compiler plugin. What we're trying to do with KSP is provide you with a compiler plugin that gives you a very easy API to look at structures, generate Kotlin code. You cannot, with KSP, change the internal representation. You cannot put in new intermediate representation inside of the compiler. So you basically just have like a read-only view of the internal structures in the compiler, and then you can generate source from that. So it's a very scaled down compiler plugin, but it is like it operates as a compiler plugin. If you want to change the IR, write your own plugin.
It makes sense. I think the original principle for annotations in the Java language was, hey, this is supposed to express metadata, not modify the behavior of your program, right? It's been abused, since then, because you can.
Absolutely.
But I guess in this case, it's going to make it really clear. This is for annotations and generating code from that. It's not for messing with the language to let you use annotations to change the grammar of the language.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that was a bit on the Kotlin. I guess we talked about the three teams now, right? So let's go back to one again. So R8 and D8, what have you been working on there recently?
So on D8, one of the recent things that we've been working on is desugaring. So bringing more modern Java language features and libraries to Android developers. So because we always have 5 to 7 versions of Android in play at any given point in time, the libraries that are shipped with those devices are also basically 5 to 7 years old, right? Because if you want to target all of the Android ecosystem, you need to target devices that are 5 years old. 5 years ago, LibCore, which is the Java standard library on Android phones, did not have anything from Java 8 at all. So there were no streams, no Java time, things like that. And obviously that's not very nice for Android developers. Like we desugared Lambdas a while back and made that available. But if you have Lambdas but no streams, then a lot of the use cases where Lambdas are really useful are kind of not there. So we wanted to provide people with Java libraries as well. So we've been doing Java library desugaring, where we're making streams and Java time libraries available for Android developers. And now we have a path forward for making more things available. So that's one of the things that we're doing in D8.
How does that work? Do you rewrite the bytecode then?
Yes, we do. So we recognize calls to all of these APIs, and then we rewrite those to call other things. So we ship our own library for parts of the library. So instead of Java time, we will rewrite all of the calls and all of the constructions of objects that's got something to do with Java time into constructions of some of something else, something called j$.time. And then we'll ship those j$ types in a separate DEX file in your app. So basically,
and that's a library that you've then checked works on older API levels. They don't depend on anything else that wouldn't run.
Yes, exactly. And that's actually done via desugaring as well. So we basically take stream and Java time code, and then we desugar that so that will run on all Android devices with yet another little compiler called L8 for library desugaring. yeah, the number 8 is all over the place here. We're not very good at naming. So we take the library code, we rewrite it with L8, which involves desugaring, so that will run on all devices. And then when your app uses something from the library, we will rewire that to use our desugared version.
So I'm curious, when you said you rewrite this code, so for the time APIs, you'll rewrite the code so it does the right thing. Is this something you can automate for these kinds of APIs in general, or do you just go method by method through everything that takes a Lambda and then figure out how to rewrite it?
A lot of it can be automated. There are a few things where manual changes have been made to the library code, but a lot of it is just dealt with by the normal desugaring mechanism that we have. So one of the things that the library uses now is default methods and interfaces. Those didn't work 5 years ago on Android, so we have to change that. So basically, we have to move the method body from the interface to a class, and then we need to put in sort of trampoline methods that end up calling the method on the class and not on the interface, because you couldn't have method bodies on interfaces 5 years ago.
It seems like you something like that specifically reminds me of what I've seen in the Kotlin code. Like if you look at the decompiled Kotlin code, where you're using a language feature that doesn't exist at the Java layer, and yet they sort of use these, you know, delegates, these intermediate generated code classes to go through.
Okay. You're absolutely right, Chad. That's exactly the same. So what the Kotlin compiler is doing, we do that as well. We just do it once the Java C has already generated methods on interfaces, because that's supported in class files at this point. So we do that rewriting with D8 when you turn the class file into a DEX file. Kotlin C does it at compile time. If you're targeting Java language level 1.6 or 1.7. So the Kotlin compiler has multiple target language settings. So if you target language level 1.8, the Kotlin compiler is actually allowed to use interface methods because those are supported by language level 1.8. So that's actually one of the reasons why we're doing this as well. Like because we care a lot about Java as a programming language as well, right? I mean, Java is an officially supported language. We really want people to be able to use modern Java features. And at the same time, we also want to push on Kotlin. But these two things are very tightly connected. Like, we can't push on Kotlin without pushing on Java, because the Kotlin compiler would like to be able to use methods and interfaces, for instance, because that would just make sense and would make it easier, and they wouldn't have to do this desugaring work. So in that sense, the fact that we can desugar interface methods means that the Kotlin compiler could just generate methods on interfaces now for Android.
And this is one of the reasons why we have recently changed the default bytecode level in projects. But there was a downside to it. Do you want to talk a bit about this? Because I think it's related to exactly this. It's related to methods on interfaces.
It's related to exactly that. And the downside is the reason why we haven't done it before is compile time. And that's because in order to desugar interface methods, for any class that we're dexing, where we're turning the class file into a dex file, we need to be able to look at all of the interfaces that it implements to see if there are any default methods that we have to deal with, which means that we can no longer compile one class file to a dex file and then just spin that up, distribute it out on as many cores as you have, and go like file by file. You have to provide a class path when you're desugaring interface methods as well, because we need to be able to look up all of the interfaces in your program. So that means that when we're compiling a class, we need to look up its entire superchain to see which interfaces are in the superchain. And that's costly, right? So if before you were only looking at one class, now you're looking at a hierarchy instead.
And this is related to the Minesticky version of your program. So if your Minesticky version is recent, there is no downside, correct?
Correct. If your Minesticky is, oh, what is that? I can't even remember the number. It doesn't really matter if it's high enough.
I want to say 24, or either 21 or 24. I think it's 24.
It's 24. I'm pretty sure it's 24. So if your Minesticky is 24, and spoiler alert, it isn't, because you don't want to target only 24. But once your Minesticky is 24, this will have no cost anymore.
Yeah, well, when you're in Android Studio and you compile, we will set the Minesticky version to whatever device you're targeting. So if you're trying to run on a device, which is probably going to be 24 or higher, you will not pay this price. So it's really just a cost when you're doing a full build on your CI server, and we are not, you know, injecting a higher Minesticky version.
Exactly. That's absolutely right.
But people
right.
do care about their CI times as well. So it yes. still wasn't a slam dunk, but we've done it now. And I think in 4.1, when you create a new project, I think we will default your bytecode level to 1.8.
Yes, that's correct. And I think that's the right thing to do for many reasons. And if we do not do it now, our hand will be forced in any case. Because at some point, the Kotlin compiler will not support Java target level of 1.6 anymore. So then that will start generating interface methods, and everyone who's using Kotlin in their programs will then have to set the language level to 1.8 anyway. So yeah. We just need to move there. We need to make it fast enough. And as you say, Tor, for most people, most of the scenarios, it is fast enough and it's not going to be a penalty. And then CI systems might be a little bit slower. Yes.
But this is the trade-off we play with in Android development all the time, right? You're trading off build time for convenience. You know, Kotlin, in my opinion, a lot more convenient than Java, but, you know, slower to compile. Bytecode, like this happens again and again, right? Annotation processors, notorious. They make some development easier. They also give, you know, have a penalty at compile time.
Yep.
So just to see if I understood the overhead there, let's say someone does want to be able to run their application on older devices, so they target API level 23, right? It doesn't reach the 24. Does that mean that on all devices in the field, they will suffer some of the overhead that you're talking about? Or was this build time overhead only?
Yeah, it was build time. So, it's build time overhead. The runtime performance should not be impacted much. Basically, we turn an interface call into a normal virtual method call.
Yeah, though if Ministic version is 24 or higher, you wouldn't desugar at all. So even at runtime, there would be presumably less trampolining.
Right. So the thing I was trying to get to was, so we have this app bundles that we're suggesting that people use for distribution now, where the Play Store can decide based on the device configuration what bits, what sub-bits of the app bundle to send down as an APK, right? So is there some future in which we could actually do some compilation as well and say, oh, this device actually has a higher API level. We should be able to, you know, compile against this version of Kotlin instead. Like, I don't think it does that now, but is there, like, is that theoretically possible for us to then compile the bits as well?
I think it would be if people were willing to let us compile their apps. I think it's dangerous though, in the sense that you would. So the case that I'm worried about is when people are shrinking their app. I'm not so worried about people uploading class files and then us compiling it with D8 with different min SDK levels. But if people want to shrink their apps as well, I worry a little bit about what that would mean in terms of debuggability and having the tools right. And we actually do synthesize rules based on your min SDK for the shrinker. So if you're using the support library in your app, there are all of these checks in the support library that says if you're on a device with a min SDK lower than 14, then you need to do this stuff. Now, if your min SDK is 15, then you're clearly not running a device that's min API below 14. Because it's always at least 15. So we actually generate rules for R8 so that R8 knows that the SDK version, that runtime check, that will return the number 15. And therefore we can shake out all of the code for previous versions. So stuff like that, I would worry a little bit about the testing matrix for that and having people not actually be able to have the actual APK in their hand and have that tested in all possible scenarios, because then we end up like generating something that's very different in the cloud for them. So in any case, that's not what they're doing now. So what's in an app bundle right now is actually DEX files. So the only thing that you choose is resources like DPI levels, strings that you want to ship, things like that, and not so much about the code. You can have dynamic feature apps where you have basically your app split up in a base and a smaller APK that you can overlay on the existing APK, and that can have code as well, but it always ships the same code to all devices.
Right. Okay.
So library desugaring, you're currently only doing libcore, I assume. Have you investigated to see if there's anything else from the SDK that you could library desugar, or do most of the other libraries require, you know, OS support?
I think most of those require OS support. I must admit that we haven't looked closely. There's still so much left from normal Java standard libraries that we haven't done. We've only done stream and time, basically. So there's a lot of other stuff like Java NIO, completable futures, all kinds of stuff.
Concurrent. Right, so you still have some work lined up.
Lots of work, lots of API surface, lots of library surface there that we could do.
Now, you mentioned that this compiler is called L8, and of course you have D8 and R8. Do you want to talk about why you keep naming things, you know, single digit plus 8?
Yeah, it's good.
Single letter.
It's kind of embarrassing, right? So when I joined Google more than 13 years ago, I worked on the V8 JavaScript engine. So that had that name for a good reason, right? Because Chrome needed a strong engine under the hood. So Lars, who was my boss at that time, and Casper probably came up with the name V8 for that engine. The V8 engine.
I'm assuming there was engine. V1 through 7 before, and V8 was the one that stuck.
Not really. I think it was just the V8.
Really?
I think
it went straight for number 8.
Well, it's the V8 engine, right? So I think that was the kind of the play there. And then the I can get back to that. And then when we wanted to do what came first of L8, D8, and R8 was actually R8. So we wanted to do an application shrinker, and we wanted to make it fast. And then there's this car, because the V8 engine and we like cars. So there's this car that's called the Audi R8. So why not? So the shrinker is called R8. And then,
is that a tiny car by any chance?
It's not big, but it's fast.
Okay.
So
I thought you were optimizing for size, not speed, but okay.
Well, if we make it both small okay. and fast, that's yes. Yes. So in any case, that's where R8 kind of came from. That was basically the name of a car that we liked. So why not call our compiler R8? One of the early decisions that we did with R8 was that we wanted to not generate Java class files, but we wanted to generate DEX code directly. So once we made that decision, the shrinker takes Java class files and generates DEX code. So if we just don't optimize anything, that's a DEXer. That transforms class files into DEX files. So the DEXing portion of R8 is called D8 because it's a DEXer. Similarly, when we extended D8 with library desugaring, that just became L8 because that was library desugaring. Now the stupid thing, Tor, which I haven't spoken too much about, so why not talk about it very publicly in a podcast?
Sure.
Is that we've actually named two things D8 and we just didn't realize it until it was too late. So when we were doing V8, the JavaScript engine, one of my colleagues, Christian, did a development shell or a debug shell where you could type in JavaScript code and have it evaluated on the fly. And since that was the development shell for V8, that was called D8, of course. And then I went ahead and did it for the DEXer as well, which caused interesting conversations with the V8 team saying, did you just name a second thing D8? And the answer is, yes, I did.
Fortunately, nice. The intersection between Android developers and web developers is the null set. So nobody will ever realize this as long as they don't listen to this podcast. So
fingers crossed.
Okay.
Of course, you know, the Kotlin compiler can spit out JavaScript. And if you want to optimize it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
So I assume this means the future versions of all these things, like the next one is going to be R9. And then it's just going to get really confusing.
I think we're just going to go with letters.
Okay.
We'll see how many other letters we can find, and try not to choose D a third time.
23, if I've done the math correctly. So I guess we have a few products left to go.
Yeah, and you can
say one three. Of the things that that actually broke when we started supporting R8 in the Android Grader plugin was resource shrinking, because resource shrinking was heavily tied to our integration of ProGuard. The idea is that you run ProGuard, you sort of limit all the code that is left in the app, and then you look at the outputs to see, okay, well, which resources are referenced from the remaining app? And I think that someone on the team actually made this work with R8 as well. But one of the limitations is that, you know, the doing this on the AJP side is tricky. You don't really know if someone is referencing a resource because these are often constants, so the compiler will drop the R reference and just get a number in the bytecode. And so if we see a number that happens to be the same number as an R field, we will assume it's the resource. Whereas I think R8 can do better. And so I know that your team has been looking into resource shrinking. How's that going?
It's making progress. So the exact thing that you're talking about there, Tor, we still haven't really gotten around to. So it works with R8 in exactly the same way that that it used to work. And what you're saying, it can confuse numbers with resources that are actually not resources. So the current resource shrinker is still going through, looking for numbers and finding the ones that look like resources, which is not fantastic. So one of the things that we did change, though, is actually something that you implemented, Tor, a long time ago, but it ended up breaking devices. So one of the things
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy.
So one of the things that you did, Tor, right, was figure out all of these resources that are actually not referenced. We should get rid of them And then we should just null out the entries in this big resource table that is shipped with your app. Unfortunately, that didn't work so well in some of the devices, as far as I understand.
It worked great in testing. And then we learned that some manufacturers, you know, we won't name them, run some sort of optimization, or I'm not sure what they're doing, but they actually will query the resource table and try to load images, even if your app is not referencing them. And that broke.
Why?
Exactly.
I don't know why, but so the solution was to insert dummy resources. So to make the resource shrinking as small as possible, I figured out the smallest possible image, which is a one pixel, you know, ping file, the smallest possible XML file, which is a single tag, like basically just so that they will be valid, but as tiny as possible. And so what the AGP resource shrinker does is, you know, find all the unused resources and replace them, not delete them, with smallest possible equivalent image and resource in general. So you've gotten rid of that?
Yes, we have. So
yes.
The thing we can do now, which Rico implemented, is that we rewrite the table. So we just completely remove those entries. They're just not there anymore. So therefore, there doesn't have to be a path in there to something that makes sense. So we can actually completely get rid of it now. So we don't have to have it. We just null it out entirely and remove a bunch of strings. So that means that that resource table that's in there gets quite a bit smaller. And we can actually remove the one pixel PNG.
And does it work in testing? Because that seemed to be Tor's main criteria.
I think it also works in testing.
Great. Ship it.
Yeah, that was a... Those were fun times.
But you're right, Tor, that one of the things that is on our table and that we would like to look at is sort of resolving some of the cycles that you can get with resources. So because there's both code and XML files in a typical Android app, you can have these cycles where there's a reference to a class in an XML file, and then...
Like a custom view. So your layout will reference a custom view.
Yep.
And the custom view will reference something back in the resources.
Exactly.
It's very difficult to currently know.
Right. And the way shrinking of your app works right now is that there's a tool called AAPT that looks at your XML files, and then it generates keep rules for your shrinker. So R8, as part of any compilation that you do with R8, we get keep rules from AAPT. So AAPT will generate keep rules. That means that we have to keep the code references, so the classes that are referenced from XML files. So that's sort of a given from R8's point of view. We have to keep these. That means that if that class is actually not reachable in your code, it will still be in your app. Now, worse, if you can't actually reach that XML, if that can never actually get into play, it can be referenced from the code, right? So you can have like bidirectional references here. So you can end up having these cycles that we can't get rid of, where you keep both the XML and the code.
Yeah, one thing that may not be clear, because I've gotten some bug reports on this, is that a resource isn't used just because it's referenced from some other resource. We create a full graph, and your resource has to actually be reachable from some root, like in your manifest or in reachable code, for it to actually be used. And that's why this analysis is tricky, and why if you could create this graph not just within resources, but throughout the whole program with code and resources, that would be ideal.
Yeah. And then so what we're investigating there is using what's called conditional keep rules. AAPT can actually already generate them, but we're not entirely there with making sure that that works. So the idea there is that you can break the cycles. If instead of saying you have to keep this class, AAPT would look at the XML file and say, if this thing on the code side, if that ends up being reachable, then we also have to keep something else. So it can make things conditional. And therefore, if something is not reachable in code, we can break some of these cycles.
One of the things that's really tricky, and you have this exact same problem with code shrinking, is that there's reflection in code, right? So you can't just say, hey, no one calls this, let's delete it. Because you could have some complicated string computation, which then calls through reflection APIs to load it anyway. And so today you have to use keep rules to say, no, this is actually kept. In resources, there actually is the equivalent mechanism. And so it is possible for resources to be in, to be used even if there's no reference to them. And so the resource shrinker has to do some pretty ugly things. And so we've added these directives where you can say whether or not you want it to be strict or if you want to be very defensive. So for example, if you're in this defensive mode, which is the default because we don't want to crash your app by accident, you know, if there's a string called foo, and we also find a in the string pool of your program the exact same string foo, well, then we will keep this, you know, the string foo, for example. And so that's another challenge here. And it's also something important for developers to be aware. There's keep rules both for code and resources. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, interesting topic. Anything else on the D8 and R8 side?
There's some interesting things related to Kotlin on R8. So one of the things is inline functions in Kotlin. So if you use inline functions in Kotlin, if you just run that on an Android device and say your inline function throws an exception and you get a stack trace, the line number for that for the top frame on that stack trace is going to be really weird. It's going to be off the end of the file into which the code of the inline function was inlined. So you're going to get these weird line numbers that are off the end of the file. And that's not very useful for you as the developer. You will be able to see which method you're in, but then the line number will not make any sense. So if it's a large method, you won't know where you are at all.
Is that because the bytecode can't express, it can express line numbers, but not line numbers in a different file. So they have no way to link back to, hey, I'm actually this inline function over there. Is that the reason?
That's exactly right. And they actually do have a way of doing that, and they do exactly that. So in the in class files, you can have source maps in an annotation. And basically that's what they do. So there's this attribute where you can store source debug information in terms of a source map. So the Kotlin compiler actually generates these. So if it sees one of these very large line numbers, the debugger, when you're debugging Kotlin code, doesn't have this problem because it can look up the source map in the class file and it can map your very large line number back to the right file and the right line number. So now because that information is available in the class file, it's also available to R8. And R8 already has to deal with stack traces that don't make sense because R8 also does inlining. It renames everything. So when you shrink your app with R8, we generate smaller code where everything's renamed, a bunch of stuff has been inlined, and we also generate a mapping file. Now that mapping file you can use when you get a stack trace that makes absolutely no sense, you can use a tool called Retrace with the mapping file and your stack trace to get back a stack trace that actually makes sense. So we've extended the mapping files with R8 to also contain mappings for these large line numbers. So R8 will read the source map in the class file, and then it will translate back these large line numbers back to the right file and the right line and put that in the map so that when Android developers get their stack trace in Crashlytics or whatever they use to get their stack traces, they will actually see the right file and the right line.
So the mapping file you're talking about, that's the stuff that ProGuard used to have where if it renames symbols to something obfuscated, it would record that in a mapping file. And you're saying that file you support for R8 as well. And now there's extra information, not just renaming information, but line number information as well.
Yes. And in fact, we had all of the support for that already in the sense that R8 can also inline calls. If you do, then there's stack traces, then there's stack frames missing from your stack trace, right? Because if you're in an inlined method, well, on the call stack, you've eliminated a stack frame. So the mapping format actually has information in there so that you can unfold all of those, that inlining as well, so that the developer gets a full stack trace that reflects the code that he wrote and not the code that's running on the device, so that he can actually know exactly where he is and where he's getting that exception. So we just use that information, but now we're also reading these Kotlin source maps and putting that information in the mapping file as well so we can give developers better stack traces.
So that is in the most recent version of R8? Like you started out by saying, here's the problem, all the line numbers are goofy. That is fixed and the developers don't need to do anything here?
That is fixed, yes.
Okay, cool.
The other interesting thing on Kotlin and R8 is that if you want to shrink a library, with Kotlin. That's a little complicated because when you shrink libraries, you still want to generate class files, and you want to generate class files that the Kotlin compiler understands. So if you have a library which has a Kotlin API service, so say it has extension methods, for instance, extension functions, then the Kotlin compiler needs to be able to recognize that class file as being a Kotlin class file. The extension methods gets compiled into basically static methods with an extra receiver, with an extra first parameter. But that's not how you want to call it from Kotlin, right? I mean, if you use that API surface from another Kotlin program, you want to know that it's an extension function. You want to be able to just call it with normal function call syntax on the extension receiver type. And the way that works with the Kotlin compiler is that in your class files, it has something called Kotlin metadata. And the Kotlin metadata is what tells the Kotlin compiler that, hey, this is not just any old Java code, it's actually Kotlin code. And this method that you see over here, which is a static method, is actually an extension function. So that's really, really critical that this Kotlin metadata is maintained if you want to shrink a library that has a Kotlin API surface. And the reason why that's complicated is that, as we just talked about, R8 renames everything, right? If there's something that you're not explicitly keeping, then R8 will rename everything to use very short names because that uses less space. It will also do inlining to get rid of methods. It will even merge classes together. If you do that, then you change the structure of your program, and that structure is reflected in Kotlin metadata. And the Kotlin compiler trusts the metadata. So in particular, something like supertypes is recorded in Kotlin metadata. So if we change the name of a supertype and we do not change the metadata, then the Kotlin compiler will say, I can't make sense of this. This supertype doesn't exist because R8 renamed it. So if we rename things, we need to rename it both in the program and in the Kotlin metadata so that the compiler can make sense of it.
Are you using the Kotlin metadata library for this?
Yes, we are.
Because I play with that a bit and it seemed pretty slow. That would be one of those things that it might be nice to talk to JetBrains about too, you know, since you have a team working on this. Maybe if we could get some faster way to read and write that metadata. Because I played with it for some bytecode rewriting and it was noticeable delay to initialize.
Build time slow or also runtime slow? Does it need to access metadata at runtime?
Build time slow unless you're using reflection. If you're using Kotlin Reflect, that's the other use case of this. If you're using Kotlin Reflect, that will also look at this metadata, because then Kotlin Reflect needs to be able to know which type of structure is in your class files. If you're looking at a class, what's an extension method? What's a companion object? Things like that.
Okay. I think we're probably over time. What did we forget to ask about in the compiler world?
Good question.
I'm thinking we covered it. Tor, anything else on your mind? Do you have?
I keep
giving
another hour. I want to talk about all the most recent optimizations you're doing. I want to talk about which ones you're planning to do.
We should
invite Mats back.
We should do another one. We didn't talk much about KSP as such, I guess. Which is fine. You should do one with the KSP engineers.
Quickly,
at a later point
where
in time.
Are we with KSP now? So I'm under the impression that we announced something, but like, what is remaining? What is your timeline? And what are the results in terms of, you know, well, early, you know, benchmarky types of results?
Right. So we just released a developer preview. So it's out there available for people to try out. It is definitely not production ready, but it's available. It's out there for people to try out. So if you write annotation processors, you should give KSP a spin. And our preliminary results show that it can be a lot faster. So KAPT needs to generate all of these stubs. So it needs to basically compile all of your code to stubs. KSP only resolves what you need. So with the API, you can look at your code, but only what's interesting to you. So it avoids looking at a lot of code for simple processing. So we see that simple annotation processing can be like at 20% of the time that it is with KEPT. If you end up looking at everything, the performance will be more similar. So you'll maybe get a factor of two, but you'll get something that's really, really fast if you, and that's what many annotation processes do, only look at a small subset of your program.
I'm assuming you've already ported some annotation processors to this.
Yes. Oh, man. But I must admit that I forgot which one it was that we used. I think it was Glide.
I think I heard Glide. At least one of the image processors.
I think it was Glide.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and that showed very nice performance results. And then we're looking to some of the other annotation processes that are used in Android as things where we can try out this technology and make sure that it works.
So what you want now are annotation processor authors to make sure that you're covering their use cases and to start porting, and then hopefully, you know, the results will speak for themselves and everyone will want to get in on this.
That's the hope. That's the hope. Yes.
I have Hilt on my brain right now because we announced it recently and we're trying to tell people about, you know, using Hilt instead of Dagger for dependency injection. And it seems like their entire world is built around annotation processing. So it would be interesting to see what we could do there.
Absolutely. We would love to work with those.
All right, then.
All right.
Let's plan a future podcast and talk about more.
Yes. Sounds good.
All right.
All right. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks.
Thank you.